why I think almost everybody should work less. So I don't think what most people need most in their life is a bit more money to buy things, to impress people that don't care. I think people, what they need is to spend more time doing what they love and to have more time off with their friends and family. So I looked at the numbers and I thought to myself, okay, right now, most of us work 5 days out of every seven. If you're an entrepreneur, you might work 7 or 8 days out of every seven. But say we work five days a week. Your ratio of days that you work to days that you don't work is 2.5 to 1. We work 5 days for every two we take off. If you take one less day a week at work, say you move to working 0.8, you work 4 days a week, then your ratio of days worked to days off goes down to 1.3 to 1. You work 1.3 days for every 1 day you take off.
Hey, what's up? Welcome back to another episode of the Life in a Show podcast. I'm your host, Jason Wojo. And on Life in a Show, we help people make more, work less, and live amazing, abundant, prosperous, incredible lives. We're going to do a legacy episode. Now, occasionally, we love to throw these in. We review our previous podcasts that were the most often listened to, the most often rated and reviewed and shared. And so these are the hot ones, the ones that people really, really enjoyed. And so we find these and we share them again for your benefit. Maybe you missed it the first time. Maybe you're a new listener or viewer and you didn't have a chance to listen to this. So this is a chance for you to get some of the gold nuggets that we have previously done so that you don't miss out. And if you like this, I want you to give us a review, give us a rating, give us a thumbs up, let us know what you can take from this, and then even share it in our Life in Air Facebook group. Just go to Life in Air. If you search Life in Air on Facebook, you'll find a private group there that you can be a part of. You don't have to be a Life in Air member. This is open to the general public, and I'd love for you to participate in there. Tell us what you thought of the episode. Let's jump into it right now. Here's our legacy episode. Enjoy. Andrew, what's up, man? Welcome to Life in Air Show.
Hey, how's it going? Good to see you again.
Good to see you, man. Andrew and I caught up here last week, and you know, it's interesting because originally the thing that connected us was he has this really, really cool business that goes on to create basically like coffee book tables for like family members to get to know each other, like say generations, like between, because you know, listen, like if you have a grandfather, a great grandfather, a grandmother, like you, I mean, how much do you know about them, right? Like and so he does this, he has this cool business that puts together stories for these people. But actually, as we got into the conversation, I'm like, how did you get into that? I kept asking all these questions, and it turns out this guy has a lot of other cool things that I think our listeners are going to love. So like, before we get into that though, Andrew, like, tell us, like, you have a very, very interesting background. Just give us a brief overview. Like, you have a pretty unique journey into entrepreneurship. Give our audience a glimpse of that and what that looked like.
Yeah, for sure. So I am a classic story of somebody who did not know what they wanted to do in life and is probably still trying to figure that out. So the way that I bounced my way around to get here is I grew up in Calgary and then moved to the west coast of Canada, did a business degree. As I was trying to figure out what courses to take, I just really liked my business courses, so I kind of chased that a little bit. And then finished my business degree and got the dream job for business students, which is working for a Big Four consulting company, and basically flunked myself out of that. It was going fine, great opportunity, great people, but I was 1 foot out the door the entire time. And so at 23, I quit that job. And then my cousin, who became my co-founder, also quit his Big Four job. He was in accounting. And then we started a nonprofit I think I was 23, he was 22. We ran that for like 9 years. So pretty quickly became entrepreneurs, even though I thought I'd probably, you know, work for a business first and learn some lessons and make some mistakes on their dime. We got into it pretty quick.
So you went into the nonprofit, and that was Mealshare?
Yeah, you got it.
And then you went into the No Story Lost.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah.
I'm really curious here, man. What is it that ties those two businesses together, and why did you choose those over all these different entrepreneurial opportunities? Like, how did you guys know that this was what you wanted to do?
Yeah. So at UVic, where I went to school, this is in Victoria, on the west coast of Canada. There was a big focus on being like a complete entrepreneur. So where other big business schools would be pumping out, you know, finance majors, strategy majors, people who are like combed to go work in the top consulting or finance firms, It was a really holistic program. And so we learned a lot about sustainability kind of before that was a big thing on like the leading edge of that. And so we watched a couple key videos that really stuck with me about, you know, about how corporations work. And also I came across this thing called the original position. So this was a concept by John Rawls. And basically it asks us to consider if we were pulled out of the earth for a minute and got to design the principles that would govern humanity, what would all the rules be? How would everything work? And you didn't know what body you'd go back into in the world. Would you change the rules? Would you make them more fair or less fair than they are right now? And so I think for a lot of us who are probably listening to this, we're probably pretty privileged and pretty lucky to be where we are. And the thought experiment goes on to basically make you realize, like, we had it pretty good. We're pretty lucky to be in the place that we're at. Maybe we should try to level the playing field a little bit. So that concept, just the way it was worded, the way the story works, really hit me. And Jeremy and I decided, like, if we're going to run businesses, we want to make the world better. And so we didn't want to just go start asking for handouts to, you know, give money to charities. We did really love the idea of running a business together and using the power and creativity of capitalism. But we know that there's so much power and opportunity in it that if it's used for good, then we can make a really big impact. So that's how we started to think, let's run businesses that make the world better. And so MealShare was the first one of those.
So what was the part of the MealShare? Like pizza every day? That's one of the rules you put
Dude,
in
that
there,
would
like
be a good world. That would be a good world. Andrew, did you got, that's what you need to work on, man.
I mean, I try to follow that principle for myself and eat pizza as much as I can. It's absolutely my favorite food. Slightly different concepts for MealShare. What we would do is partner with restaurants and we'd put our little logo next to a few menu items. So if somebody goes in and buys a MealShare item, they get their meal like normal. They don't have to do anything, but they provide one meal to a youth in need. So we take a little bit of margin from each of the items that was sold and use that to buy meals for kids. Basically saying, look, if someone comes in, they don't even notice, then the restaurant's doing good. They're donating to charity. And if someone comes in, they don't know what they want to order, they might think, oh, I might as well get the one that feeds somebody because there's nothing I have to do, nothing out to pay. So again, just trying to like leverage capitalism for good as opposed to asking for donations kind of thing. So we were inspired by Tom's Shoes, which is a buy one, get one model for shoes. We asked ourselves, how can we do this for food or for water, something really, really important and basic for humanity? And also even then, like I was really inspired by something like Tesla, where Tesla didn't go and say like, please buy our electric cars because then you'll like take emissions off. No, they just made the best car that's ever been reviewed. Like it literally, when it was released, it was the highest rating has ever been given to a car. And they said, if we make the best car available, we'll switch a bunch of people over to driving hybrid or electric cars. And that's how we'll make our impact. So again, thinking about how you can, you know, be the best, be a great entrepreneur and make impact as opposed to just asking people to do good.
Dude, I love that, man. And so what is involved? Like, so I'm curious, how did you get this idea specifically? And how did you formulate this? Like, so you have this symbol, and I know I'm getting a little tactical here, but I'm curious because like this might have a light bulb go off for somebody else. So you have the symbol next to the menu item, and the restaurant has agreed to like pay for another meal. You were negotiating with the restaurant owner. Like, how did that work?
Yeah. I mean, again, there's a ton of margin in most items that are out there in the world that we buy. Usually a lot of margin available. And so we said, look, if they're going to make $25 off a given item, now I know restaurant margins are tight, but on the particular item, if we could take a portion of that and then they would give it to us at the end of each month, then we could buy a meal, because actually feeding a person a really basic meal is incredibly cheap. Like the way that society and humans have built up the food industry over the past couple hundred years means food is insanely cheap if you're providing something pretty basic. So yeah, we went to restaurants first to like prove the concept and asked, in theory, if we ran this, would you put it on a menu? Would you then give us a little piece? And a lot of restaurants were saying like, look, I get calls for charity donations all the time. And there hasn't really been much that's been built for restaurants in the past. It's basically just random charities asking us for money. So this would be really nice for me to have something I could actually invest in and provide an impact with repeatedly and like stand behind. So we accidentally landed on a thing where actually, restaurants don't have a good way to get that. So we thought our concept was cool, and I think it was, but we also hit a real business need that we didn't really know existed, which is kind of how it worked out. But yeah, we'd go into restaurants, we'd say, hey, can we get a minute of your time? They'd say no. We'd come back at a quieter time, then maybe they'd sit down with us for a minute. We'd ask them to join the program. We'd outline all the benefits of it, how it exactly worked, how we made it really easy for them. And at the end of a month, they would just report how many items they'd sell at the given items that they'd chosen and send us a check. And then we provided meals with our charity partners from there.
So the charity partners provided the meals. You guys gave the money to the charity partners and they've,
yeah.
Dude, bro, I love that story because it's such a merger of so many different things. Like, what a cool thing, dude. I love that. Yeah, you really blended several different things into one. Genius, man.
Thank you.
So, okay, now, but then there's a little twist here, right? Because we had this little thing called the global pandemic happen.
Uh-huh.
So what happened there?
So we had 500 restaurant partners on the program at this time. So we're fast forwarding like 8 years. So it's 7 years. It's 2020. We have 500 restaurant partners. We're building a huge partnership with a chain that works across Canada, which had another 1,000 partners about to join. So we really, like, I think we were near a million ARR, maybe over that, and about to double or triple. And then it became illegal to go to restaurants. So we went from 500 restaurant partners to 80 between March and April, and even some more dipped off after that. So our revenue was down like 90% in a month, and it stayed down for a long time. I'm not sure how it was for you, but especially in Western Canada and in Eastern Canada too, the rules are really tight. So people were not going to restaurants, and restaurants were feeling a big squeeze. So even the ones that were open were not able to get back. Like, one problem with that business is we were always the first thing to go if a restaurant was struggling, because it was an optional thing, as opposed to us like providing them revenue or providing them a service they really needed. It was always like a nice to have. So the business, I mean, we stayed open. We had some government subsidies. We trimmed the team down in hours so that everyone could stay on if they wanted to. And we limped along for a couple of years, but yeah, it really was never the same after that.
Got it. And so is that where you transitioned? Like, at some point you made a decision like, hey, and by the way, so when did you decide and how did you decide to move on? Because this is a challenge, right? Like, when you had a business that was successful and you go on hard times, did you have a rigid criteria? Was it an intuition? Like, when did you decide and how did you decide to move on?
Yeah. So you're asking about lessons learned kind of in the story early on. And so one nice thing that I've done a couple times is to sunset things as other things are kind of rising up. And so that's helped me de-risk things a few times. So when I was about to leave Deloitte, my consulting firm, Jeremy quit his job right away. He was like, I don't care. I'm out. I'm not doing this. I was like, how about we build MealShare up a little bit before I just quit? And so we took 6 months from kind of the time we agreed to do it before I actually left my job. And then when I was leaving, I actually lucked into this one, but my company offered me a leave of absence for 6 months. So through that transition, like, I really got to build MealShare for a year before I had to officially quit. And if it all blew up in my face, I could just go right back to where I was, have the same job, same salary, same security. So that was, yeah, super important. When you look at the stats of how often startups fail, so nice to have that safety net to catch me. Then we'll talk a little bit about how we evaluated our next business and the opportunity there. But I had started working on No Story Lost before COVID even happened. Obviously, never knowing, never sitting in a strategy meeting wondering what will happen if a pandemic happens. But nice to, again, have, like, maybe we have the next thing, like, simmering on the back burner in case we want to switch or in case something happens. And so in 2019 is when I started capturing my grandpa's story. So that happened really organically. My family had always talked about how grandpa had the best stories, how we'd go to family dinners, he'd sing songs, tell stories, entertain the group, and have these like quick little one-liners. And so for 20 years, I heard, oh, someone's going to sit down and write his stories down while we have the chance. I keep hearing this, no one does anything. Finally, I'm home from the West Coast, and we sit down and I just type and type and type while he tells his stories. And then the next time I sat down with them, I thought, maybe I just record rather than try to type it live, and we'll transcribe it later. And so I was seeing the early threads of there could be a service here where we do this for families. Because when we got the book produced, it was like pretty basic. Like, this is a fairly capable human pulling this together for the first time. And so it's short, it's black and white, there's like mistakes in it, but it showed me like, it's so cool to have these stories, and it was a ton of work. And so when you see these types of things as an opportunity, that this is really great, but it was crappy to do, you always try to look for like, is there a business here? And so we got that off the ground and did some friends and family projects, just evenings and weekends. And yeah, to answer your question, that was kind of ready to go.
Hey, we'll get right back to our episode, but before we do, I want to tell you about our business builder workshop. Peter, I love this event, man. Why do people need to go?
Yeah, because you are going to be designing your own business, right? If you haven't been successful in the business as well as you would like it to, this is the event to be, because we're going to be working through everything. It's like an MBA in 3 days for your own business.
That's right, man. We cover everything from systems, processes, automation, hiring, sales, marketing. It is like what Peter said. We've had a woman who went to business school. She said she learned more in 3 days with us than she did at 2 years of her business school. So if you would like to make a transformational change in your business as well, go to lifeinner.com right now, click on the Business Builder Workshop, register for event, and we will see you there.
As you were talking about it, one of the things I'm hearing from you is you're an entrepreneur. You're an entrepreneur at heart. And you, as you're going in the venture, you have some kind of an exit strategy in mind, in the back of your mind, just in case kind of a thing. I think that's one thing I'm hearing. Second thing I'm hearing is you always look for something that you can kind of fall back on. And the third thing is, you know, as you're revealing some of those things that you just mentioned about the meal plan, the book now, then you also, I know outside of the podcast, you talked about some other things. So entrepreneurs tend to have a lot of freaking ideas, right? So how do you work through that? How do you, because I imagine like people are listening to it, especially people who don't have a business in place. They probably have a lot of ideas. They probably have a lot of different things that they're trying to accomplish and things like that. And you can get stuck in that kind of wondering, and how am I going to make this work? So what's your take on that? How would you advise somebody as they're going through that kind of a process?
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite quotes, I think, is Ray Dalio. He says, maturity is the ability to turn down good opportunities so you have time to pursue great opportunities. So especially as we get become better entrepreneurs, become more senior in our careers, know more people, and have more opportunities, you're going to have to actually say no to a good opportunity in order to make room for a great one. There's not going to be a shortage of things that you could work on. So Jeremy and I, while we were at MealShare, started wondering, what will we do next? This might last for 90 years. It might end tomorrow. What will we do with the next thing? We knew we'd want to run something else together because our partnership was working so well. And so we built a little nerdy document in Google Sheets called the Venture Attractiveness Calculator. And so we'd run businesses through that and ask ourselves, should this be one of the top ideas we consider when we do our next thing? So of course, that would include traditional ways to measure how attractive the business is. So larger wins, and is it in a rising industry, and all those sorts of things. But I think more importantly, and I think the lesson that more of us could learn here is asking, is the venture attractive to you as a person or you as a partnership, or your skills and what you want out of a business? So we did to kind of two main categories. And the first one was like non-starters, things that if they don't meet these, we're not even going to consider this business. So is it good for people or good for the world? If it's like net bad for the world, we wouldn't consider it. We also said for us, does it allow for remote work? And can we run it as the sole decision makers, Jeremy and I? So that basically means tech, SaaS, like not an option for us because we're not technical. We could bring on a third co-founder. We found that we work best when he and I can just make decisions together. And we've actually like clashed, and it's been a weakness of ours when we have a third person who's like a co-founder decision maker with us. And will this allow us to do engaging, non-repetitive tasks? So that way we're not building ourselves a little nightmare of like having to do the same thing over and over again for 3 to 5 years. Those are like non-starter criteria. And then after that, we would run it through a whole bunch of more things. So the non-starter means we don't waste our time evaluating businesses that we shouldn't even think about at all. And then if it passes those, then we can start to rank it on all the business criteria plus all the criteria of like what it would mean for our day-to-day. And then we'd spit out a number at the end and then see if we wanted to pursue it. And so we didn't like finish the No Story Lost one and say, this is it, start it now. But it did quite well. And then and we were building it sort of for our own need anyway. Like we went through all the steps to finish our grandpa's book. And then we had a friend who wanted to do the same thing. So it kind of had that organic start as well. And because we had ranked it well, we weren't like, hold the phone, like don't get caught down this path. We knew, okay, it scored well on our criteria and it's kind of naturally happening. So let's let that happen.
So okay. Andrew, on these criteria, is it like a 1 to 5 scale or how do you, and are you weighing different questions like differently? Yeah. Or are they all just equivalent?
Yeah, there's different weightings and yes, we score things out of 10. And we also write notes next to them too. And then importantly as well, if we took a while between ranking things, we'd go back through the previous ones quickly so that we're in the same headspace. Because I could see leaving 4 months and then ranking completely differently the next time. So we kind of had to recalibrate sometimes as well.
Do you mind sharing any of the business ones you're looking at? Are you talking about like, hey,
yeah,
potential for top line revenue, net margin, gross profit? Yeah. Like, what do you...
Yeah, a couple of categories there. So financial leverage, mine and Jeremy's strengths, and then just startup considerations. So in financial, yeah, like could this be sold someday for 7 figures? Is it low risk? Does it? We also had to rephrase everything in a way so that the yeses and nos in the answer would be positive.
Calculated
so like, that we didn't have like conflicting answers. So does it not require running a huge debt, like buying a facility? So even these questions, which are more about the business, are still catered to us because that doesn't mean it's not a good business. It just means we don't want to touch it. So in my head, it was like the financial ones were very objective for any business, but you can see even these are painted to our preferences. The industry is growing. We're on trend. We actually put points for it's not sexy because we know how much competition that could bring if you're chasing like a sexy business, the hot thing at the time. Market potential and if it solves one of the great human desires. Don't quiz me on what those are, but there's like a good set of what the great human desires are, and chasing those I think is always a good opportunity. Yeah, so that's the financial section, and then there's more about leveraging, which Jeremy and I are good at. And then again with startup considerations, we asked ourselves like, does it have low startup costs? Does it allow a slow ramp or phased entry as we transition out of meal share? Can it be started small and tested and then scaled? Simple corporate structure? Are there businesses to learn from and copy? Again, there's probably tons of businesses that are great opportunities that don't fit these, but that's just the type of things we wanted to chase.
So I love what you're saying there because of the criteria. I think a lot of entrepreneurs, when they have all these ideas, they say, will it make me money? Yes. So that's, I'm going with it, right? That's the basics of their criteria, right? But you dive a little bit deeper, not only from the financial perspective, but as a partnership perspective, skill set, and things like that. The other thing I heard you say in there, does it meet our day-to-day? So are you saying that, does it align with my life? Are you considering that at all?
Totally.
And what does that actually look like?
100%. So one of the first ones, like I said, is remote work. So it's super important to me that I can travel. I get down to Phoenix every winter. I want to be able to work from there. I want to be able to work from a cafe. And again, someone else might not prioritize that, but those things are so important to our lives. And to a point where we're obviously leaving other opportunities on the table and not pursuing them, possibly to our own detriment financially. But there's a lot of things in my life that I've happily sacrificed salary in order to have more time and more freedom of what I work on. And it's interesting because I was not like a rebellious child at all. And I was good in school and like got good report cards and always like was fine with my teachers and other students. But as an adult, I'm realizing how much I don't like to be told what to do.
You're a rebel now, aren't you?
I don't think that really matches. Right. Yeah. I guess I'm a rebel in the workplace. But yeah, again, I would all day sacrifice my where I could be career wise with salary to be where I am, where I work where I want, I work when I want, I work on what I want to work on, and I work with who I want to work with. I think those things are priceless.
Man, I love that. And like we, you know, within Life Here, we talk a lot about like creating a business that's built around your vision for what you want your life to look like. And so you've done this, man. Like it's awesome. I love it. Very much overlap with what we proclaim as well. So you've had these business experiences and you've put together like a list of frameworks that have helped you be successful that also, I think you want to, I mean, cause you also have a heart. We've talked, you have a heart for kind of helping other entrepreneurs be happier and helping them through the lessons you've learned as well. Would you mind sharing some of those things that our audience would benefit from?
For sure. So I guess another de-risking or thinking of the next thing or the fallback thing is I took a coaching course a couple years ago. I've always just naturally kind of coached friends. I had friends joke that I should have like a talk show called Just the Facts, or like people will just come to me to like analyze their problems and just hear what I have to think about it, which I feel great about. Like that warms my heart and it's just something that comes naturally to me. And so when you think about your purpose or like your ikigai, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with, one of the questions is like, what's something that you do really well naturally anyway? That's like a really good signal that it might be something you should chase. So I've always kind of done some coaching, but I wanted to make sure I had the right structure and frameworks to provide coaching as a service. So I have one coaching client right now. I like to have ideally one at a time. If No Story Lost blows up, the next GPT release kills our business, I'd want to have the next thing I can potentially do. So in the meantime, I'm happy just doing it part-time. So I wrote down a couple that I thought you guys might like. We can spend more time on them if you want. I guess I put a ton of all the lessons that I learned the past 10 years into a book that I wrote. So this is my book and it's just full of business and life advice. And I don't actually really sell it. I just give it to friends and coaching clients. But the chapters are goal setting, decision making, thinking, psychology, philosophy, people, getting things done, startups and business, happiness, all that kind of stuff. So that's what the thoughts are in the book. Here's a couple favorite ones. So why I think almost everybody should work less. So I don't think what most people need most in their life is a bit more money to buy things, to impress people that don't care. I think people, what they need is to spend more time doing what they love and to have more time off with their friends and family. So I looked at the numbers and I thought to myself, okay, right now, most of us work 5 days out of every seven. If you're an entrepreneur, you might work 7 or 8 days out of every seven, but Say we work five days a week. Your ratio of days that you work to days that you don't work is 2.5 to 1. We work 5 days for every 2 we take off. If you take one less day a week at work, say you move to working 0.8, you work 4 days a week, then your ratio of days worked to days off goes down to 1.3 to 1. You work 1.3 days for every 1 day you take off. So if you took off every Wednesday for the rest of your life now, you'd never work more than 2 days in a row. And I just think that that is a crazy transition. So 5 days to 4 doesn't sound like that much, but the ratio of days you're taking off for days that you work goes way down. To do that, you still make 80% as much money in theory. If you're an entrepreneur, you might make more than that. You might make less than that, but just call it basically you're going to make 80% as much. It's probably more tax efficient money because you're not getting taxed with the margin on the last 20. And you have so much more time to spend with friends and family and doing your favorite things. I think that's what most of us need more of. Not to mention, especially if you're a parent, which I'm not, but if you're a busy adult parent, you might only get 3 margin hours a week where you feel like it's your time because you're not driving kids to school, doing chores. Like, how many hours a day do you actually get that's just you time? Well, if you're, instead of taking, we're not just adding 8 to 10 hours a week to a huge pile of 3 hours you had. You might have only had 3 hours before, and now we're giving you 10 more a week. Like, that radically changes how much free time you have. So I think most people who have their means met, what they really need to do is work a little bit less, and you'll be happier that way. What do you guys think?
So I love that. I just want to clarify, like, are you saying you take off specific day, like a Wednesday, or is it doesn't matter as far as
sure,
what day it is?
Friday, Wednesday. Okay. I mean, Wednesday is funny because you'd never work more than 2 days in a row ever again. But Friday is nice because you get 3-day weekends. Doesn't matter. Whatever works well for you.
I like that. I mean, that's what we talk about a lot on the events, because there was actually, you know, what was that, Vojo? The Pareto principle? Which one is it?
Yeah, Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. Yeah,
this would, yeah, I mean, you know, it kind of applies to it. And we find a lot of times with my students and entrepreneurs, because when you start working less, I think you become a lot more intentional in what you're doing. Because you're going to have to go and, you know, for, let's say, like, I work between 10 and 2. I work like my hair is on fire, right?
Yeah.
To make sure that I get stuff done. I mean, some people, I'm going to mention.
Well, clearly, some of us are better than others at that, Peter.
What's that?
Yeah, clearly, some of us are better than that at others.
I still got my hair, so I'm just not mentioning any names. But hey, but yeah, I love what you're saying there, man.
Cool. Should we jump into another one, or did you?
Yeah, let's cover like one or two more, man.
Yeah, cool. Okay, this is kind of a random one, but I think it's fun. There's something called the peak end rule, and it basically says that we remember an experience based on the peak of it and the end of it. So when you look back on a given vacation or a week at work or the study they did, which was like a doctor's appointment where you have a surgery, if you look back, you're going to remember the emotion you felt at the peak and at the end. So when we're thinking about how we design weekends, experiences, birthday parties, we should think about the peak and the end. And so the surgery example is like, basically they just want to make sure that they have a really soothing end to the surgery so that you just hack human psychology and they just remember it a bit less painful than it actually was. I like to think of it for when I was like, I designed a friend's bachelor party last year. I was like, let's make sure there's one really high peak. That's their absolute favorite thing in the world. But then also at the end, like, oh, let's just put him in the lounge at the airport at the end and like have a really good peak experience at the end as well. And then you can kind of hack the whole thing and improve the whole memory of the experience by hacking those two items. Instead of trying to make, let's try to make the whole thing a 6 out of 10 instead of a 4. If you just do those two hacks, peak and end, you can improve the whole experience.
So it's like a hangover movie. All right, gotcha.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know if that applies to anybody's businesses or just experiences they're designing, or there's lots of ways you can apply that.
Well, I'm even thinking about the customer or the client experience, like, right? Like the experience they have with you as your company, let's say they, after the experience concludes, the service concludes, are you doing a good job of following up with them? Or is there a thank you letter? Is there something special, a little surprise gift in the mail, like something like that?
Yeah, what's the last touch point they have with you in their journey, and can you improve that? So for No Story Lost, we do what's called a delight item, which is nowhere in their purchase, but the interviewer gets to know this person really well over the time that they're together, and they often make friends and want to stay connected as pen pals. So they know the person really well. So we're shipping them a book, we're putting it in a box, we're adding a card, and then they'll buy something for like $10 and we'll put it in. So it might be a postcard from where they were born. It might be a program from their favorite sporting event. And so that arrives in the bottom of the box too. And so they look, they pull out their book, they're amazed by that. But then they see like, oh, this person, like, this is not a robot who wrote my story. They like, they really understand me. And this was a total bonus. So we try to like hit that delight thing right at the very end.
Oh, wow, man, that's awesome. That's super cool. That's cool. Dude, I know we're running tight on time, but let's just sneak one more in. I just have to do it. Yeah. Like, there's so much good stuff here.
Okay, cool. This references a book. So I keep a book list of all the books I've read. And again, a bunch of the lessons are in there. So I love the concept of the dent. So it's by Seth Godin. You guys probably know him. He's written a dozen books, a lot of marketing books. But the dip is just this really short book. So everyone could read it in an hour or two today. And it basically says that when we're learning a new thing, say you're picking up a new sport and you start learning it, your enjoyment over time will rise quite sharply. So you're enjoying that thing. We get endorphins, I think, from like trying new things and getting better at them quickly. Then as we get further along the curve and start trying to get better at something, we'll enter what's called the dip. So the enjoyment for the time you spend goes down for a while. So this is like your athlete who's training to become, let's say, a top basketball player. This is the like 1,000 shots by yourself taking free throws in the morning, because that's the edge you have to get now to get better against the competition. And a lot of times we'll all quit during the dip, because we get to the dip and we're like, this kind of sucks now. I don't want to do this anymore. We aren't getting that reward for our work anymore. And so he says the people that fight through the dip and get back up here. It's not until you've gone through the dip that you really get all the great rewards that are offered to people who fight and become the, what he calls, the best in the world. So that doesn't mean you need to be the best in the world, but you're amongst that top 1% in the world at something. And there's a couple takeaways. One is, if you know it's something that you're going to just quit in the dip, you're better off actually not spreading your attention out and going and quitting a bunch of things. You're better to pick one thing, become the best in the world at it, and then you receive all the rewards from being, you know, you get invited to the things, you get the awards for the things, you get paid to do that thing as a professional. So super eye-opening for me as someone who's generally been a master of none and dabbled in a lot of things. I saw the dip chart and I was like, this is me. Like I've gotten pretty good at so many things, especially sports, and I just quit during the dip. And I've never found the one that I want to like put in those gritty hours and fight to be the best in the world at. But I think it completely applies to business as well. You know, it's like building a podcast. I'm sure you guys will see, like, putting out the 87th episode and the 213th episode, you got to just be going through that dip where you're like, okay, our followership paused for a while, but like, when are we going to become the best in the world? And we're the one with this 500th episode, and then we're getting the rewards from that.
Well, yeah, man, it's interesting because, like, you know, that I've heard that concept before, and it's kind of like, it's almost related to the question I asked you earlier, where it's like, when you're not getting the external rewards, you're not enjoying it so much, like, how do you know, like, I got to push through, or maybe this is a sign that I'm not supposed to be doing this. And that's where I think most people opt automatically to the, like, oh, you know, it's not what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, now, like, it's something else, and they go on to the next thing and they experience the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. So how do you, I mean, you asked me the really tough question about meal sharing, like whether or not I should have thought through it when it was dying or just let it go. And I have a mastermind group. Like, I talked to the guys about it a bunch. This was like a lot of heartache for me, which is like, I've built this for 8 years. Do I just let it go now? Am I going to cling on too long because I like it and I'm proud of it? Or do I need to fight through it? And so in that case, I used the regret minimization framework, which is a Jeff Bezos piece, which is like, what are you going to look back on and regret? He basically says you want to try to avoid regret as much as you can in the future. And so I knew that if I didn't give it everything, I'd probably look back and wonder what if and feel like I quit too early. So we went through a bunch more heartache, and it's a whole other story and a whole other episode what we went through to try to save it. But looking back now, I can like rest easy. Like, we did everything we could. We tried to save it. We tried everything. But at least I'm not now regretful being like, oh, I kind of gave up.
Man, I got to tell you, we're out of time, but I've really enjoyed getting to know you, and I'm so grateful and appreciative of your perspective and your views on, like, just making the world better, right? Making people better, like making this place a better place to be for everybody. I love that so much, man. It's so cool. I love seeing that. How do people learn more about you and find you?
Yeah, I'm not actually personally too big on social. So no story lost on any of the social networks. We're on there. I'm on LinkedIn. And if you want to follow there, I do a little bit of writing. I'm hoping to do more. I actually just like drip this whole book out as LinkedIn posts over the next couple of years.
Oh, so cool.
You might see that pick up. You might not. But yeah, nostorylost.com and no story lost all the socials too. Thanks for having me too. And thanks for all the kind words. Appreciate it. It was fun.
Hey, that's a wrap for the episode. Hope you enjoyed it. You know, let us know what you learned from it. Let us know what you think of the podcast. Leave us a rating. Give us a thumbs up. Tell other people about the show, because this is how we can change the world. We can change the community around us, and we can shed a light into other people's lives to help them live the vision that they also are pursuing, so they can live success to their own definitions. We'll see you next week, everyone. Take care.